Welcome to Poetry and Everything. I'm your host, Judith Arcana. On this show, we'll have guests who are Portland poets, nearby poets, faraway poets, pairs of poets, groups of poets, maybe even folks who are not poets, all of them reading and talking about poetry and everything. I'll almost always read a bit of my own work. I'll definitely always read some work by other poets. This is our first show. I'm delighted to have as my guest Harold Johnson. I'll be introducing him formally in just a few minutes. I want you all to know that tonight's show, this first Poetry and Everything, is dedicated to Barbara LaMorticella, who was a monthly KBOO poetry host for many years in the grand fashion. So here's thinking of you, Barbara. Thank you very much for all of it. So I'm going to read. This is a poem of my own, as in a home of your own. This one's called Zombies on Skateboards. We met in the center of the city, near a captive tree in the plaza, a tree locked in a circle of iron bars with sharp points. He was growling, shouting, loud, "People, give us your change!" He was one of a pack, white kids with dreads, dressed in grimy surplus khaki, holding confused dogs on leashes. Those kids were tattooed with art that looked like money. He reached for my Phoenix in Flames, held my arm next to his Zombies on Skateboards. I said, "Good name for a band." He laughed, looking into my eyes. We were inside each other's eyes. He said, "I bet you can remember the day the sun was born, Grandma." All right. Now, my guest tonight is Harold Johnson. Harold Johnson, most of you in the local listenership out there in Portlandia radio land know of Harold's work for a long, long time. I first encountered him maybe about 20 years ago when he was one of the editors of Fireweed, one of Oregon's really lovely little magazines, a small poetry journal. A lifelong resident of the Pacific Northwest, born in Yakima during the Great Depression, grew up during World War II, has serious cred, street and otherwise. And I love this phrase that he used, which I found on a copy of one of his current books. He called that time a time of great focus in the nation and tranquility in the Yakima Valley. During and since college, he's lived here in Portland, except for 2 years, as a bandsman in the Army between the Korean and Vietnam Wars, and that time was certainly a source of the seeds of the seeds and roots of his new novel, which I hope we'll be able to talk about after we fill your ears with poetry. Harold is married to local painter Ann Griffin Johnson. He's a longtime teacher of visual arts and English, a musician, an artist, the kind of guy that makes most of us think, "I can do one or two things. What about him? I don't want to think about it." He has 2 chapbooks and recently a collection of poems, Citizenship, and even more recently that novel I mentioned, The Fort Showalter Blues. So, Harold, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Judith. Very happy to be here.
Good. Glad to have you here. So you, too, have at least one poem by someone who's not you or me, and I've brought a couple little ones. Do you want to start? Who have you got, and what
sure.
do you read to us, please?
What I've got is, I think, a poem that says a lot about the time by Adam Zagajewski. It's pretty well known by now. I think it was a response partly to the 9/11 event called Try to Praise the Mutilated World. And it was originally in Polish, translated by Renata Gorczynski. Try to praise the mutilated world. Remember June's long days and wild strawberries, drops of wine, the dew, the nettles that methodically overgrow the abandoned homesteads of exiles. You must praise the mutilated world. You watched the stylish yachts and ships. One of them had a long trip ahead of it, while salty oblivion awaited others. You've seen the refugees heading nowhere. You've heard the executioners sing joyfully. You should praise the mutilated world. Mm-hmm. Remember the moments when we were together in a white room and the curtain fluttered. Return in thought to the concert where music flared. You gathered acorns in the park in autumn, and leaves eddied over the earth's scars. Praise the mutilated world, and the gray feather a thrush lost, and the gentle light that strays and vanishes and returns. Adam Zagajewski.
Yeah. Nice stuff. Good choice, as the waiters say in restaurants all over town. Good choice.
Yeah, thank you.
Have you got anything else by someone else, or are we going to hold with that one?
That's enough for me.
Okay, I'll do one.
Like
okay, I've got a poem by Connie Wanick. It's called Directions. First, you'll come to the end of the freeway. Then it's not so much north on Woodland Avenue as it is a feeling that the pines are taller and way more. And the road, you'll notice, is older, with faded lines and unmown shoulders. You'll see a cemetery on your right and another later on your left. Sobered, drive on. Drive on for miles. If the fields are full of hawkweed and daisies, sometimes a spotted horse will gallop along the fence. Sometimes you'll see a hawk circling, sometimes a vulture. You'll cross the river many times over smaller and smaller bridges. You'll know when you're close. People always say they have a sudden sensation that the horizon, which was always far ahead, is now directly behind them. At this point, you may want to park and proceed on foot or even on your knees.
Beautiful.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, it is.
And you know, I brought a couple, but because I wasn't sure what I was going to read. But when I heard what you read, I thought, oh, this one.
Yeah.
They're a nice pair.
Sort of mesh.
Yeah. Thanks, Harold.
Thank you.
All right. Now... It's time for the Harold Johnson Show. You told me when we were talking outside the studio that you had not only brought, of course, Citizenship, your new collection, but also some new poems. So why don't you read to us, tell us about which ones are from Citizenship,
sure.
Maybe give us some background about the book if you care to, tell folks where they can get it, and then tell us about your new stuff, too.
Well, Citizenship is a gathering of poems that I've written perhaps over the last 15, 20 years, and that were sort of scattered out there. I sent a lot of them out. And at some point, before I got involved in working on the novel, I got them together. The Northwest is a very big part of whoever I am. I was, as you indicate, I was born in Yakima, and I still feel like a small town American from the Pacific Northwest if I'm in Cincinnati or Paris or Amsterdam or any place else. One of the big features of my trying to grow up in Yakima was having an older brother who was the local high school superstar for about 3 years and the most famous person in town, so that everywhere I went for years, the first thing people would ask me was, are you related to Gene Johnson? because his name was in the newspaper year-round because he played three sports.
That's rough coming up under that.
Yeah. Luckily, we got along very well. He was a sort of sweet-natured guy, but a dynamo on the field, and everybody thought he was the greatest guy in the world, and I was his little brother. Not so sweet. But this is sort of a memorial poem. He died in 1999. Mm. One of the things about him as an athlete was he was terrifically fast. He actually had world-class speed. This always dazzled people. But this poem is in memory of him, and sort of there's a lot of biography in here, too, as you'll see. It's called My Brother Dying Elsewhere. He had settled in Newport News, Virginia, one of the places that he had been a baseball player, professional baseball player. Yeah. As that approaches, which you will not outrun, I wait here in the far west of our childhood, near the other great ocean, where the newspapers called you halfback sensation, dusky speedster, mercurial base runner, untimed, but surely the fastest boy in the valley, where running cost nothing, widest known name of the time, in the apple capital of the world, where your slow brother followed you to the golf course, where a woman with a southern accent said, I want the fullback to caddy for me, where we pegged away summer afternoons at the neighborhood park, where the white boys who seemed closer than cousins, teammates and classmates during the war and after. Negro was the quiet box we checked in that town that cribbed our elders, but knew surer than Jesus Jackie was coming. And he did. And the Republic Herald cheered when the Dodgers invited you to America's dream of working-class boys. We walked to Seattle First National and cashed the bonus check, stuffed the 50s, 20s, and 10s in our pockets, and walked home. Children of the poor are also sent quickly to war. After Korea and wounds, a few more diamonds in a few small towns, a wife and house in Virginia, you settled for playing out our hero dream on fairways, a continent away. 5 months ago, your touch was good when we chipped golf balls on a muggy afternoon. It's cloudy, wet, and dark here. For hours, the wind has whipped water against the windows. Over the phone, your voice's core sounds short on breath, so that it could have been any ghost's voice. Any time now, boarding will begin for the flight east. It's My Brother Dying Elsewhere.
Hmm. 99, you say?
1999, yes.
Died in 99.
Yes, he got stomach cancer from that southern diet, I would say. Uh-huh. Watching people eat back there. Mm.
But what he had was good.
Oh, yes.
So.
Yeah.
Okay. Read some more to us, Harold.
Okay. Let's see. Let's look in the book. Something that will echo maybe a little bit later. I've always been sort of preoccupied with the presidency. The first poem in the book is about the artist Gilbert Stuart,
mm-hmm.
who painted all the presidents. Not all the presidents, all the early presidents, right. About the first six.
As many as he could get to.
That's right. And he was quite a busy guy. Some years back, visiting some artist friends in Baltimore, we visited the National Gallery, and I saw all these fresh Gilbert Stuart paintings. They had just been cleaned, and they just sparkled. And somewhere along the line later, this poem came to mind. It's for Richard Rizak and Julia Fish, actually two well-known Portland artists who don't live here anymore. Mm. It's called And You, Gilbert Stuart. Sometimes it appears to be all buying and selling, At the Capitol, in the National Gallery, I stared, again with vague hope of riddling the ambiguity of my citizenship, at the salmon-colored faces of the first few presidents, chanting of soap and water and beef, above foaming white collars and waistcoats, locked in the ledger domain of your brush as long as paintings last. And now, back home out west, I sit in my studio before an empty canvas, thinking of Celilo, the dam-doomed falls where men stood on rocks and logs, dipping nets, facing cold spray in the red rays of their sinking day, ellipsis to the long sentence of their history and the drowned future of their rights. Power must be served. And I think of Yakima up the river, where a black boy whose grandfather was born the year of the proclamation loved schools called Adams, Madison, Jefferson, Washington. Washington, the good slave master. Master of the minuet, refuser of crowns, surveyor of free ground that he sold for many dollars. And you, Gilbert Stuart, painter of presidents, who they say had a habit of reeling in suckers twice. Didn't the great American purchaser sit for you to begin the century on canvas? And by 1805, weren't you still dancing around his inquiries with the excuse that you weren't satisfied with the painting? And didn't you sell it to the fourth president, whom you'd also painted along with Dolly? And didn't you finally in 1821 slip the old sage a slick copy, purportedly the original, his daughter remarked the wet paint, on a mahogany panel. Canvas had been embargoed since 1801. Oh, yes, you did. And you, Gilbert Stuart.
I love that last line.
If your grade school was like mine, there was a Gilbert Stuart portrait of George Washington somewhere.
I knew
there.
When I first read that poem, I thought, I know that picture.
Sure, sure.
Absolutely.
He was actually a good painter.
Yes.
Very good.
That's why they wanted him to take their images.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, also from... From citizenship, let me read a couple that sort of involve another character important to me, my wife.
Another good choice.
Yeah, she's a pretty good choice. This is sort of a birthday poem, yeah. I don't think I've ever read this poem before publicly. Poem for Anne. The old judge, past 100, still holding court, said, I don't even buy green bananas anymore. I, too, hear footsteps, but plan to be here tomorrow. It's your birthday, and I have love and a whatnot or two to give you. Tomorrow will be delicious bananas yellowing on the kitchen counter. Robert Graves, lying wounded in France during the Great War, said the poem he was working on kept him alive. You be my poem. I must be here when your face opens at the sight of these sunflowers and their dark centers, and to hear your quiet but always fervent appreciation of the mokara's feline spots I'll spring on you after. A day of getting up, stretching, breathing in the bombings, oil spills, massacres, poltroons behind mushrooming microphones, and then breathing it out and finishing the last of the oatmeal. Off Broadway, and then some, where trees shelter quiet streets, has worked so far. Sunk into habits of body and mind that we try to turn to music, the thing Pater spoke of. Poem for Anne, birthday poem. Mm-hmm. Pater said all art tries to ascend to the condition of music. That's more or less a paraphrase.
He was ranking the arts.
Well, he was trying to describe them to the best of his ability. I sort of swing with that, that view.
Yeah. I don't know.
I got to think more.
I've heard that before. I admit I haven't read Pater for like a million years. Mm-hmm. I got to think about it. I don't know.
You know, yeah.
Certainly poetry can be said to aspire. Mm-hmm. Poetry can be said to be a kind of music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you think about the nonverbal aspect and the kinds of things like contrast and transitions and so on and so forth, it's really pure in music without, words or paint or anything.
Right. Yeah.
So that I go along with that. And T.S. Eliot has quite a bit to say about that in one of his utterances, too. He talks about the meaning music, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And he's talking about the
principles
involved, I think.
Uh-huh. I think you're right.
Another short one from Citizenship is smell theory. Actually, the her in the poem is my wife, who had a studio downtown right next to the Broadway Bridge, that where they used to put those mannequins in the window that you would see.
Uh-huh.
There were artist studios, studios up there, and this was one winter. It's called smell theory. We hugged. Her thick black coat told of fire, and the scent was in her hair when she returned from the studio. A tramp to escape the cold snap had no doubt got into the lower part of the building and built himself a little fire that prospered too much, that alarmed the street before dawn, smoked out the architects upstairs and the mannequin shop and the artists above them. One of the neighborhood homeless that roamed below the lofts, perhaps a Nez Perce from up the river, shivering here 10,000 years later without trees or family or animals under steel and concrete that curbed the river. Stiff, puffy guys with cigarettes stuck to lips, trying to keep warm. Maybe a woman with them. They've got coats, but this freeze feels as big as the nation.
Mm.
That's smell theory.
Mm. Mm. You know, in a completely different mood, but yet what you said reminded me of it. Years back, even before I lived in Portland, mm-hmm. when I came here, actually on a book tour, mm-hmm. all about words, it's all about words. That's why I got to think about that music thing.
Uh-huh,
but anyway, that was when still the Church of Elvis was upstairs at that corner, Broadway and whatever it is, that little teeny street. And I was smitten with it when I was a visitor. This was in the early 1980s. And then I was so, I got to say, dragged when it disappeared,
mm-hmm.
when they took it down. The Church of Elvis people decided it was no longer time to have that here in Portland. What was that? I don't know, 18 years ago, something like that. I don't know why. At the time, there was some mention, but it was another thing where you would look up into the windows and see stuff that people had put there that was not what you usually look up and see, you know? Another kind of making art, to speak.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a rather interesting thing to do with the building.
Oh, yeah.
There's an artist, I think he was British, somewhere in the world. I just happened to notice in one of the recent journals, in the windows, he's painted huge faces and things like that, and they're quite striking. I mean, he's made an art thing out
of
it.
And is he painting on the inside of the glass or on the outside of the glass?
Inside the building, actually, so that it shows through the window. And I think some of these buildings are damaged, too.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a rather striking kind of project.
Yeah, it's like a kind of squatting. He can just go in and do it.
Apparently.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Okay, what else you got for us?
Well, let's see. How about a couple that I think reflect what's happening in the world these days? It may be a little dark, but that's what we have to work with.
It is indeed. Let's deal with reality when we must, and we must.
After the explosion, in a city of biblical name, men swarm in the street. A young boy wails as if forever after. My grandpa is dead. My grandpa is dead. My grandpa is dead. His prepubescent body writhes in the embrace of a man who pats his hair. Men stumble from broken buildings, slap their foreheads, claw at piles of rubble. A voice shouts, "Somebody shut that kid up."
Whoa.
You listen to things like what's happening in the Gaza Strip or Syria or a lot of places, and it's not hard to imagine. And you might even talk to somebody who's been there. You might have some idea of where this is. It's called Song for the Dark Loa. The Loa are the sort of spiritual beings, spiritual, part human maybe, beings that are not uncommon to Caribbean religious experience.
Associated with Vodun, no?
Yeah.
I think that's where I've heard of it. Yeah. Yes, please.
Yeah. Anyhow, this is Song for the Dark Loa. You hover now after the quake, don't you? Over the island's divided humanity. Over zany angles of concrete. Over paper scattered with numbers, names, ink. Dropping food, water, pills. Dropping machines, for Christ's sake. Peur de place for landing on the bleeding side. An archbishop died under the rude fact of rubble. In the pictures, curbside bodies shine with dust and fly wings. Death and life in the weather. Strongest hands grab first droppings. Human and medical waste closes in. The bouquet of excrement now outdoes the smell of rotting flesh. We'll be lucky not to drown in our own shit when the rains come. Questions swarm about what you had in mind. A dizzy president deduces a possible curse. Trees long ago torn out for firewood, surrounded by water and not a drop to drink. The offing choked with unreachable aid. People pray all night and sing. Song for the Dark Loa.
We're listening to Harold Johnson, who is a guest tonight on Poetry and Everything. This is Judith Arcana. Back to you, Harold. Please continue.
Well, I mentioned that I seem to have had this lifelong interest in presidents. Maybe it was because one of the biggest events in my early life was being elected student body president of Washington Junior High School back home. The presidents have always been a serious interest of mine, just in the way of what goes on in the world. Without saying anything about what's going on right now.
Right here. We won't talk about that.
Right. Let me say that the last section of citizenship is called the curse. And what it is a series of poems. They're actually part of a larger work in progress. I got the idea, I don't know, probably 25 years ago.
Whoa.
It just came to me, I should write something about all the presidents. And, I never imagined anything like Barack Obama. But I wanted to have this African-American, the voice of African-American experience speaking to the presidency. And I say, I never imagined Barack Obama. Well, I never wrote it for a long time, although it was sort of cooking there. And by the time I got around to starting it, here comes Obama, and I have a different kind of problem in a way.
Definitely.
Yeah, and I'm still wrestling with it. But I have a draft of all 44 presidencies.
I was going to ask you that, because, of course, in the book, there are, what, 14?
Right. Something like that.
A dozen, something like that.
I just went up to Lincoln.
Yes.
A selection of presidents up to Lincoln, most of whom were slave owners.
Indeed.
Actually.
Yes.
But I have a draft of all 44 presidencies.
Amazing.
It's really an interesting contemplation.
I'll say.
Let's see. I would like to read a couple of these at least. In the poem or poems, I never mention any names. I just number them.
Mm-hmm.
Like one, height 6'2", weight 170 pounds, multiple serious infections, gloomy apprehensions, bad teeth. Or two, 5'7", weight 170 pounds, muscular, depressive, tremor, toothless, snorer, drinker. Two, not everybody's favorite, second captain of the kleptocracy. You thought you should have been first. Away from Virginia, other heavy dominion of bloods and whited sepulchres. The piper's son stole a pig and away he run. But seriously, folks, a serious man who, whether you dug his program or not, was not disposed to touch the shit, even while neighbors owned such property. Negro slavery is an evil of colossal magnitude. I sure does agree, Captain. That's two. A little bit of three. Height 6'2", weight 172 pounds, headaches, depressive, buttock boils, bad teeth, hard of hearing. Oh man, what do you say? We thank you for your fine words that gave what you thought was union a point of departure and something to catch up to one of these days. Oh, yeah, there was a whole lot of slaves at your place, too, down in the Dominion, and who by their three-fifthsness put you in. Too many reports agree you gobbled some golden meat with your salads, spawned a line that history memorized and keeps broadcasting as if science had not long ago buried the need for all that. You with your little architecture and your nails and your university and your great purchase that added all them slave states, all your erections. Maybe you were great. Great testimony that fumbling with each other in the dark is merely what we does. Still, my bill contains the colossal magnitude of your manlike misapprehension and its legacy of my nature. It remains, let me hear an amen, saints, remains in the skew from sense and in the unrighteous pop-eyed choking on greasy amusements in the temples of money, cars, and lapdogs, remains in the bloated, ill-fed futures of your slaves slogging like lost cows down flooded streets at the mouth of the Purchase, remains in your dishonest and limp-dick discussions that go nowhere. I declare these truths to be self-evident. That's enough of that. But that's three. As I said, most of the first 16 were slave owners, although not all of them. But a later one, an example of a later one.
Oh, yeah.
Might be 40 here that you might recognize. You will no doubt recognize. 40. Nearsighted. Colon cancer, prostate cancer, shot by a citizen, survived. You ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine. A B-movie performance while the press cheered and the gap began to yawn. At that Philadelphia, it hurt. You down there where Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, boys born of women, got murdered for trying to do democracy. You down there announcing your campaign with a load of racist code for the wizened hearts, headpiece filled with straw. Talking about welfare queens, backing tax exemption for a racist college opposing MLK holiday bill, pretending you not so sure Rev wasn't a red sympathizer. Purveyor of bogus tales, scapegoating me, man, perpetuating division, making the poor poorer. You ain't never caught a rabbit, and you ain't no friend of mine. Time you lurch from the White House, never seen so many of us on the street begging, strung out war veterans, sleeping in doorways, under bridges, no private place to pee. You said you was high class, but that was just a lie. First thing you did after checking out was collect $3 million for exhibiting yourself in Japan, then headed for the hills. You ain't never caught a rabbit.
Mm. Do you think about creating a book or a chapbook, a zine, I'm not sure how long it would be, with all that is just the I know you've got the ones that are in citizenship, yeah. But putting all the presidents.
That's what I'm doing.
You're going to make it into one book.
Yeah. It's about 98 pages.
All right.
No, yeah.
Excellent. Well, do you have a title for that? Or is it too soon to ask you that?
I have a title.
Yeah.
It's called Article 2.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Anyhow, it's cooking.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to read with Clem Stark at Broadway Books in September, and I will probably read quite a few from that.
Excellent. Yeah. So we can get more Harold Johnson and more presidents, folks. Get that. Broadway Books in September. The man will be there.
And you'll be getting another president very soon after that.
Yes. You'll have to write real fast if you're looking to end this book at the end of the year or thereabouts.
Yeah, I'm trying to have it. I should have had it finished before now, according to some.
Well, they'll just keep coming, you know.
Well, I wanted to stop. I wanted to stop at Obama. I mean, it was like...
talk about the big finish.
Yeah, yeah. I thought, well, that's kind of a good way to end
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if it fits, there was a little note there about veterans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but I get concerned about the way we talk about these heroes and everything that we deploy any number of times all over the place, especially mm-hmm. these days. And then you look at who's out on the street when
yes.
they come back.
Yes.
If it's not out of place in this...
No, go thing. Right ahead. I have it right here in my notes,
oh, really?
Sir. I wanted to ask you if you wanted to read a bit of the novel. The Fort Showalter Blues, Harold's newest book, this novel. Yes, continue, please.
Well, I just happened to have a little passage about that.
And, excellent.
And I wrote this a long time ago.
Which just goes to show you that when stuff is real... It moves through time with us.
Oh, okay.
It's not like out of date.
Okay, okay. You know? I'll buy that.
Yeah.
You know, well, at one point in the narrator is an army bandsman, and they're down in the Southwest. At one point, the band is going to play a gig for a couple days at Silver City, New Mexico, and this guy is sort of knocked out about becoming a jazz musician at this point. But he has been to college. He has taught school for 1 year, and he's got concerns about the world. And he and his buddies are on the bus and driving to Silver City, and they stop during the trip at a veterans hospital for lunch.
I remember this, yeah.
Yeah, and it goes sort of like this. If it won't take too long. On the bus ride to Silver City, I fake sleeping so I can lie in peace with fresh thoughts of Nikki Nanette's cushiony body molded against me. She's a singer he met while he was playing a game. And stood in war with no heavy brothers or nobody. If we didn't have this parade to play, I could be jamming at the box. Nikki there, swinging, Come see me when y'all get back from New Mexico, baby. Miss Lady and me. Could happen. And Corazon in that black dress with the sheer jive covering her shoulders down to the bloomings of her bosom. Rock of my soul. And there's a soundtrack of tunes, chords, lines of melody under my earlids. Some applied mathematics ain't nobody ever heard. Sip-a-dip-a-dee-bop. Swink's elbow against my arm breaks into my picture show. The bus has stopped. Guys are in the aisle yapping and moving around. We're in the mountains. Low mountains with long-needled pine trees in front of a whitewashed stucco veterans hospital. Midday. Chow time. After we eat, nurses wheel a bunch of the old guys out under the here-and-there shade of the ponderosa pines around the building. They wheel them down the improvised board ramp laid across the steps next to where we're sitting. The nurses and the old men leave a trail of tobacco and disinfectant smell when they pass by. Seems there are four female nurses working this part of the building. Each woman wheels one of the vets out of the big double doors and goes back and wheels out another one until they have four ranks of four lined up on the grass. A bunch of battered rowboats, seasick soldiers, oarless, out there on green water, ready to sink. Sinking. Oh, man. Sergeant Howell comes out of the building and stands next to where I'm sitting on the steps. How are you, Bertie? Fine, Sarge. How are you? The narrator is also the company clerk, so he and the first sergeant are kind of tight. I'm doing okay. Howell pushes out his lips and sucks on his teeth for a minute, runs his tongue along his teeth, bellying out his upper lip, studying the flotilla of wheelchairs on the grass. None of this for Howell, all his years in the Army. Master Sergeant, retire before long. His brown eyes and his big round face look quieter than usual, darker. Not so ready to fire off some countrified jive or holler a command. Got some chow in him, looking like he could use a toothpick. He gives himself a couple pats on the stomach, and his hand with the bulky Masonic ring comes close to my head. He eases down the steps, stops at the bottom. All right, men, everybody fall in over there beside the bus. Everybody gets up from where we're sitting and mumbles across the grass to the bus. Mr. Tappendorf is there waiting for us, the commanding officer. Red splotches on his face, his blue beard shadow like Vice President Nixon on TV, and no smile. I still have never seen this cat looking as if he's happy to see the band. Sergeant Howell approaches him with a salute. Tappendorf hits the bill of his cap with a couple fingertips, turns his back to the group of us gathered at the side of the bus, and talks low into the first sergeant's ear. Howell stands with his fat forearms at his sides. He gets through the lending his faithful ear and walks over to us. Okay, at ease, he says. Mr. Tappendorf has arranged for the band to play a couple of numbers for these people. You won't need your pouches. You have your Men of Ohio and you have your Gary Owen. Them's what we're going to play. So y'all get your instruments and form up over there in front of them steps. Moochie Grosso limps sleeve to sleeve with me for a few paces. The band leader decided that his gait wasn't impaired enough to excuse him from this gig. Dino didn't complain, happy as usual grab-assing with his buddies. He says to me, "You hear Howell? You have your Men of Ohio. You have your Gary Owen. Louisiana bastard starting to sound like Tappendorf." He punctuates this with what I'm calling a willy pump, a weak filly pump on account of his ribs. God help us, Dino, you're right. The driver's crank rattles in the lock of the luggage compartment and the lid opens out of the side of the bus, khaki and brass. We swarm at the compartment, pulling out instruments, and so on, and down a ways. Okay, man, over there by them steps where I told you, Sergeant Howell says. We head for the spot. Still unwrinkled in our khaki short pants and shirts with our knee stockings and black army shoes. On the bus and in the dry heat of the hills here, the uniform is comfortable except for the shoes. Inside army shoes, my feet never get a good grip on grass or concrete or wood or asphalt. Swink punches my shoulder and jerks his head toward the old men in wheelchairs on the grass. What do you think about this, he says. I think it's not too uplifting. Swink doesn't laugh. His eyes blaze madder blue than usual, as if he'd like to do something drastic. "I think it sucks," he says. "This place is a fucking meat locker." And when he says sucks, the word has a juicy sucking sound, but acts the opposite, like you might get sprayed if you stand too close in front of the cat. "Yeah," I say. "Anything army nowadays, that's all Swink has to say about it. It sucks." All I could say was, "Yeah," fresh from what I saw in the empty corridor I came out into after taking a pee. No nurses or doctors around. An old soldier in a wheelchair left out in the hall, his munching gray monkey face covered with white stubble that yellowed around his mouth. No teeth. The seersucker robe was open and the fly of his blue pajamas. He fingered his penis and grinned till his gums and tongue showed. One foggy blue eye half closed, the other bulging and runny, didn't register me as I tipped through his pissy bouquet. Maybe tell Swink and Gilson about it later, but right now, too hard a subject. I'm in the wrong damn place. Me and my desperate pussy thoughts and dreams of a voice. Old man soldier drooling, mush-brained at the end of his life, homeless in a wheelchair playing with his weenie is what's real. Out on the grass, some of the old soldiers in wheelchairs puff on cigarettes. Loose-lipped, leaky smokers killing themselves faster, puffing on those things. Bet you could measure their days in smokes. Joe Dokes had a 17-smoke Thursday. Half of them look like they're asleep, sitting out there in their pajamas and robes, about the same shape as the old guy in the hall, the bullshit white heroes the nation claims to care so much about. Tongues stuck halfway out their mouths, no good anymore for tasting or talking or French kissing, skin flaking, disappearing, flake by flake. Nobody cares. What a piece of work is. Man. That's enough of that. But anyhow, that...
Yeah, it's, as you say, it's about then and it's about now.
Yeah.
Certainly here in Portland, we read about, talk about, think about, encounter in our lives those very guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Many of them without homes.
Yeah.
And supposedly taken care of by Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
Uncle Sam's not a very good caregiver, as we say these days.
In spite of our claims,
yeah. So it's good you put that in there, Harold.
Yeah.
It's good to have the real stuff in the fiction stuff. So now I have some questions. We have some time left. Again, folks, the guest tonight on Poetry and Everything is Harold Johnson. I'm Judith Arcana, your host. We're going to wind up with a couple questions, which no doubt you will have answers for.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, because you are skilled in so many arenas, one of the questions that came to me immediately was, when you think about the relationships, we spoke about this a little bit ago, maybe at the beginning of the show or before the show began, when you are thinking about the relationships between your visual art, your music, your poetry, your teaching, and now, of course, the prose of the novel, what, if any, thoughts do you have about the relationships among these ways you use your art spirit? Do you think they inform each other? Do you think they contradict each other? Do you think they're fighting? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What thoughts do you have about that combo and the fact of living with all of that?
I don't think much of myself as a thinker. But I have feelings about
okay.
it. For instance, I've always drawn, not so much in later years now, but as a kid, and then I studied art formally, and I taught art and drew, and then I wrote a lot, too. In high school, you know, I was one of the editors of the newspaper and so on, and sort of whatever I feel like doing, but I noticed when I started writing the novel, it seemed like a big painting to me. I thought about it sort of like that.
Can you say more about that? How was it like a big painting?
A large abstract painting. Well, say a large abstract painting where, you know, you have color going on which could stand for anything in a novel. And you've got these nuances in the color and the transitions to other colors and that sort of thing. Same thing, well, with music, the music thing, you know, you got to get some contrast. You know, you have foils in things.
Uh-huh.
In the novel here, you got the heavy brothers.
Yes,
and
indeed.
Then you've got this little cadre of friends he has, his buddies, who are just pretty much the opposite, but then there's some things. I mean, it all just sort of works together in a way. But there are a lot of what you might call analogies floating around, uh-huh, as I'm working. It's like
between and among the forms. You
mean. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. You know, sometimes I'll feel like I'm painting maybe when I'm writing.
Ah, yeah. That's a great line, Harold.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyhow, that's what it is. Uh-huh. For a long time, I had this feeling of a great big book with, you know, the pages, and you know, this is all of this stuff is going on here, and
uh-huh,
sort of like drawing on it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
One of the things that I thought about when I was reading the novel is that, because I was thinking, of course, of my own writing in various forms, so I thought, okay, why did he choose a novel for this story?
Mm-hmm.
Why not write, given the relationship between the contents of the novel and your own life, why not write a memoir? Why did you want to make fiction using all of that real stuff that you experienced? Why did you want to make it art? Well, of course, memoir is art too. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I think I get you. And I went through that.
Uh-huh.
You know, I actually started writing a memoir. Now, I've always loved the novel.
Uh-huh.
I always loved the novel. I mean, the first great novel I read when I was in high school was Anna Karenina.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah,
yeah. And it sort of blew me away, just that experience. And then I read War and Peace, and then I read Brothers Karamazov,
mm-hmm,
and I'll tell you, the world has never seemed the same since then. Something I can't say I understood all of it. I really enjoyed it. I knew what was going on, but after reading that, there was something about, something like, man, this is about as far as things can go. And I don't know what it would take to shake me about what can happen in life after reading this book.
Uh-huh.
It was like that.
Uh-huh.
And it's still like that. And that was 1952 in Seattle.
And so you want to do that too.
Well, it was
hence a novel.
You know, that moved me as far as the novel goes, and I did start out. I was thinking memoir when I got back to prose,
uh-huh,
and it seemed inadequate because I wanted to get a lot of voices and other voices, one way or the other.
Uh-huh.
You know, with characters, you can have characters say all kinds of things,
you
right?
You can make them say anything.
Yeah.
You bet.
And then the experience of characters, like a couple of them just kind of stood up, and it's like I knew them from way back. And
even though you had actually invented them.
Yeah. Well, uh-huh, I guess I call it, I'm writing along, and this woman singer appears.
Yeah. And she's a seriously important character in the novel.
She's very serious. I will say that I realized later, she has a lot of the characteristics of a woman I knew very well,
uh-huh,
who was very important to me, who's in here,
uh-huh,
actually. That sort of thing.
But it rose in your mind. You didn't say, I'm going to do this.
No,
came in, and then you said, oh, look what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Some person I saw maybe briefly might have triggered a whole character. Like the character who becomes his sort of mentor, the blind guy.
Yes.
The sort of Ray Charles, whoever else guy there, the old master. Yeah.
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 And the thing about... I can't remember which character was the one who first says to Joe, Joe Birdsong is the name of the primary character in the novel, folks. This novel, by the way, is available at Broadway Books in Portland.
Thank you.
And no doubt elsewhere. And it's in our library. I know this. Now I lost my train of thought because I started plugging Broadway Books. Not a bad way to lose your train of thought.
Right.
The way that Joe makes the dis- well, I don't want to do a spoiler and tell folks the way the novel ends, but the way that Joe begins to think about what he does at the big decision that he makes at the end of the novel. Is that a friend, one of the people who really matters, another musician at the fort, says to him, you know, you ought to do this. Mm-hmm. You ought to do this. And there's people throughout the book, including that wonderful thing that you've created, where he sees his actually dead father, the daddy figure, including daddy, tell him, Joe, you ought to do this. You should do this. You should do this. Mm-hmm. You should do this. Mm-hmm. And several of them have impact, like the woman, the singer we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But in one particular case, there's a character who says that and says it repeatedly, and that's the decision that he makes at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, did that just happen, or did you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to have this guy be the one who says X to Joe Birdsong, and then Joe Birdsong is going to do X.
You know, it just developed, I think.
Okay, that's what I want to know.
Yeah, that character was sort of special.
Uh-huh. Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, I have, of course, a zillion more questions, but we're just about out of time.
Mm-hmm.
I thank you so much for giving us this much of your time and for doing a reading.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's always fun to at KBOO and read.
Absolutely.
Barbara, if you're listening, hello, and it's really good to be back out here and remember the good time we had together out here.
More thanks to Barbara, yes. Yeah. So I want to close with telling you folks this. Next month's Poetry and Everything will air on August 22nd. And our guest on that occasion will be A.M. O'Malley, who's the executive director of Portland's excellent and wonderful IPRC, the Independent Publishing Resource Center. A.M.'s got a new book out called Expecting Something Else. She'll read from that and maybe more. We'll see if we can get her to read like Harold read for us. And we'll talk, of course, about Poetry and Everything. So thanks for listening, folks. Support independent bookstores, independent reading series, and, ta-da, independent radio.